You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning, everybody. Sorry to start a couple of minutes late, but our guest of honor had a lot of books to sign. I realize it's a slightly melancholy note to start on, but I think it's very much in the spirit of the occasion, since we're going to have two of the outstanding newspaper columnists in America up on the podium here in a minute to note with deep sadness the passing of David Broder yesterday. It was, of course, meaningful to all of us who live in this town. He was a great loss to this city, to this nation, and this world, and I might add to the profession and the sub-profession that David and EJ represent so outstandingly themselves. Each of them knew David very well and might have a thought or two to say themselves. But this is going to be a fun event, and I want to say just a couple of words about our guest of honor. If the phrases public intellectual and thought leader mean anything, they certainly apply to this guy up here in the front row. But given the subject of David's book, which I had a chance to read, it took actually two crossings of the Atlantic, David, which you can take as a compliment. It meant I didn't skim it. Given the subject of that book, which is called The Social Animal, as you all know, and many of you now have it, and I hope many of you have it autographed, there's a little bit of irony in the labels of public intellectual and thought leader as applied to David Brooks. And that's because the words intellectual and thought, when attached to the word leader, suggest a big brain, which he certainly has, and a good brain, which he certainly has. Yet in the book, David makes the case that that particular organ isn't all that it's cracked up to be, if I can put it that way, and that thinking is very often affected and even trumped by feeling, and that cognition is shaped by something we all know and understand, which is emotion, as well as by a couple of factors I'd never even heard of before, which is to say metis and limerence. I wouldn't be astonished if those words come up in the conversation today, so if you don't know what they mean, you will over the next hour. Now, that's as far as I'm going to go in characterizing the book. If you want the authoritative short version, read his column in Tuesday's New York Times on the new humanism. But just let that be the teaser and read the book itself, because it is truly ambitious. It's dazzlingly eclectic, syncretic, and integrated. It knits together neuroscience, psychology, sociology, and, of course, politics. And that, I might say, makes it a book that is very close to Brookings's interdisciplinary heart and, I would say, our brain. And so do some other features, both of the author and of the book itself. In marshaling data and analysis, David cites a number of our scholars, Bill Galston, Carol Graham, Bill Sawhill, Ron Haskins, the latter two being here this morning, whom he knows, because we are very proud to have David as a member of the extended Brookings community. He actually has some fun with that association in the book itself. Harold, his protagonist, is sufficiently, what shall I say, cognitive to join a think tank. And on page 312 of the book, there's a hint of which think tank it is. It's a place where, and I quote, the senior fellows, I don't know where this next line comes from, former deputy secretaries of this or that, engage in a Washington institution called, in capitals, the powerless lunch, at which previously influential people dine and have portentous conversations of no importance whatsoever. So with that, I'm going to turn the podium over to David, and then I'm going to let my friend and colleague, E.J. Dion, take the proceedings forward. E.J., as you all know, is a senior fellow at Brookings, who, among other things, presides over a Brookings tradition known rather prosaically as the Friday lunch. I leave it to E.J. whether we're going to rename it, as David suggests, and E.J., I also leave it to you on whether you're going to make that decision cognitively or emotionally. So please welcome David Brooks to the lectern.
Thank you, Strobe. I hadn't realized how close that hit to home. The scholar, I was thinking of the Brookings Institution when I had my guy become a fellow, and I won't go deep into that. Let me just first start by saying, let me just echo quickly, and I think E.J. may talk about this too, just the debt we all owe to David Broder. He was a University of Chicago alum like me. He was editor of the Maroon. I was not editor, but he came from the school newspaper. And one of the true honors of my life is in the early part of my career, I would get confused with a guy named David Brock. And then I felt incredibly proud when later in my career I used to get confused with David Broder. And so our names were similar enough so the names rolled off the tongue. And he was sort of the dean of our profession. And whenever I do something extremely cheesy, I think, well, would Broder really have done this? And so he set the standard for what we do. Now, let me quickly describe how this book came about, and I'll just talk for about 25 minutes or 20 minutes just to give you a sense of it. And it came about actually from some advice I got from Robert Novak when I took my current job, which was to interview three politicians every day. And I don't always do that, but I do try to do it. And from that much contact, I can tell you they're all emotional freaks of one sort or another. They have what I call logorrhea dementia, which is they talk so much they drive themselves insane. But what they certainly have is incredible social skills. And so when you stand around most of them, they stand too close to you. They put their hands all over your faces. They rub. Since Strobe is here, I'm reminded of a Bill Clinton story I tell. I was walking through a hotel lobby in Boston, and Bill Clinton came out of the elevator, and he saw me, and he started praising me for a column I'd written praising him, which he thought was particularly astute. But then as people see Bill Clinton's in the lobby of the hotel, they gather around, and to embrace them in our conversation, he starts backing up. And after about 3 minutes, he's about 80 feet away over there just talking to me, but just so he can embrace the whole crowd. And he's, of course, the dean of social skills. And if they don't have it, they fake it. I was campaigning. I was following Mitt Romney around New Hampshire in the last election cycle. And he was with his five perfect sons, Bip, Chip, Rip, Sip, Dip, and Lip. And he was going into a diner, and he introduced himself to each family at each table and asked, what village in New Hampshire are you from? And then he would describe the home he owned in their village. But he goes around the whole room, and we're leaving the diner, and he starts first naming almost everybody he's just met. I thought, wow, that is skill. And then just a couple of weeks ago, I was up at the NIH, and I met a neuroscientist who showed me a video of a young girl with Williams syndrome. And from the outside, Williams syndrome looks like reverse autism. And so only interested in social interaction. And so this young girl who was 18 months was about in a room with a 12-year-old, and he was juggling and knocking over stuff. And she had no interest in any of the physical objects he was touching. She just wanted to look into his eyes. And she had no social fear, so she stood right up to him and just peered into his eyes. And I was thinking, this is every senator I've ever covered. And so they are these socially adept creatures. And yet, when it comes to policymaking, it seems to me they slip into a different mode of thought, which is very dehumanized. And so in the course of my career, I've covered a series of things we could have done better. One of them, I was covering the Soviet Union, actually, I think before Strobe got there. And one of the things that struck me was that we sent teams of economists with privatization plans and hard currency plans, but what the country really lacked was social trust. And we were sort of oblivious to some of those problems. In Iraq, obviously, we sent in the military. I think our leaders were oblivious to the psychological and cultural realities of the country. We had a financial regulatory regime based on the assumptions that traders and bankers are more or less rational, self-interested creatures who won't do anything stupid en masse. And then I've covered school reform most concentratedly over the last 30 years. And for much of that period, at least until recently, we've spent a lot of time reorganizing the bureaucratic boxes, small schools, big schools, charters, vouchers, and we've skirted around the core issue, which is the relationship between a teacher and a student. And that's because if you mention the word love at a congressional hearing, they look at you like you're Oprah. And we're just very uncomfortable with that kind of language. And so the question arises, why are our politicians really good at thinking socially on the campaign trail, but why are they not so good when it actually comes to government? Why do they become basically human CBO reports? And why do we use that methodology to analyze our problems and ignore the most important things? And so I eventually came to the conclusion that it's not just politics, it's a broader distortion in the culture, that for centuries we've had views of ourselves as divided selves, that reason is divided from the emotion, and that society progresses to the extent that reason can suppress the passions. And this has led to a view of human nature upon which many academic disciplines are built, that we're rational individuals who respond in straightforward ways to incentives. It's led a way of seeing and studying the world, sometimes borrowing the methodology of physics and applying it to human behavior. And I think it's led to a great amputation, where we study the things we can count and measure and then ignore all the rest. And so it's led to a distortion, a breeze in the culture, so people are really good at talking about material things but bad at talking about emotions. I did some stories on college campuses a few years ago, and people were really good at talking about skills and academic accomplishments but really bad at talking about character, the most important thing. And so Alistair McIntyre, the philosopher, has this famous metaphor. He says, we have words like virtue, vice, sin, but we no longer have the system to understand how they fit together. And so I think there's some truth to that. And so I think there's sort of a prevailing breeze that leads us in a more shallow direction than we need to be. And you can see it famously in how we raise our kids. If you go out to Bethesda, where EJ and I both live, and you go to an elementary school, at 3 in the afternoon, you'll see the third graders coming out, and they've got these 80-pound backpacks. If the wind blows them over, they're like beetles stuck there on the ground because we want to weigh them down, because we want to weigh them down with academic accomplishment. And then, you know, the cars are driving up, and in Bethesda, it's usually Saabs and Audis and Volvos because it's socially acceptable to have a luxury car so long as it comes from a country hostile to U.S. foreign policy in Bethesda. And so the moms are coming out, and they're highly successful career moms who've taken time off to make sure all their kids can get into Harvard. And you can tell the Bethesda moms because they actually weigh less than their own children. Sort of at the moment of conception, they're doing little butt exercises. The kids are plopping out. They're flashing Mandarin flashcards at the things to get them ready. They take them over to Whole Foods on River Road, one of the socially enlightened grocery stores, where the cashiers look like they're all on loan from Amnesty International. And they buy the seaweed-based snacks, which we buy in my household. It's called Veggie Booty with Kale, for kids who come home and say, Mom, I want a snack that'll help prevent colon rectal cancer. And so the point is that they want to give their kids some sense of social enlightenment, but the language isn't there, and it turns into Whole Foods. But the dominant pressure, and they're sort of trapped in a world of tiger moms, or at least what they perceive to be tiger moms. And it's a world of an arms race, where other kids, they feel, are doing all this studying to compete in this meritocratic system, and they find they can't unilaterally withdraw, even if they're uncomfortable with it. And so life becomes a series of achievement hoops, SAT prep, hobo practice, soccer practice. If you look at the way kids are raised today, it's much more supervised than it was 30 or 40 years ago. And there's been sort of this revolution in child care. And the kids go to high school. Walt Whitman High is our local high school, where they play lacrosse. the upper middle class kids realize they can no longer compete at football and baseball, so they've stolen lacrosse from the Indians to give them something to dominate. And then they sort of get off into competitive colleges. They have a sort of a GPA mentality. What do I need to rise and succeed? They become the junior workaholics of America. They master the sort of facts you learn at PowerPoint presentations. And then they go off, and some of them become successful, and they go off to have vacation homes in Aspen or Jackson Hole. And when you see them in midlife, they're kind of impressive people. They've made some money. They're often so tall and elegant and slender. They don't actually have thighs. They just have one calf on top of the other. It's sort of impressive. They marry other beautiful people, and they've achieved a sort of genetic miracle. So their grandmothers all look like Gertrude Stein, but their granddaughters all look like Halle Berry. I don't know how they do that. And then so they lead a successful life, and they go to things like the Aspen Institute to get some ideas. But again, the prevailing pressure is it makes all that kind of vague. And so they focus on career accomplishment and often on health. And there's often in these couples, and it's true in Bethesda, a tension in the marriages because the men in the workout routines, because the men go jogging and biking and only work on muscles in the lower halves of their bodies. And the women want to wear sleeveless dresses, so they do push-ups and pull-ups so they can crush rocks into their bare hands. And then when they get older, maybe they haven't developed a philosophy of life, but they've succeeded at everything else, and they just decide they're not going to die. And so they're about 90 years old. They're popping Cialis like breath mints. They've shrunk down. They get their personal trainers. They're like 5 feet tall, 90 pounds, covered head to toe in spandex. And you see them jogging and racing up mountains with a grim, determined expression. Makes Dick Cheney look like Jerry Lewis. And so you'll be hiking around Aspen. You'll see them zoom by you. And it's like being passed by a little iron raisinette as they're going up the hill. And so this is the life I think the prevailing winds are blowing us to. But as you're studying some of the aridity of our policy world and some distortions in our culture, one of the things I discovered several years ago was that there's an antidote to this great amputation, to the shallowness, I think, and the winds toward shallowness. And oddly, it comes not from theology and not from philosophy, but it comes from the study of the mind, from the neuroscience, cognitive science, psychology, social science, and behavioral economics, and many other spheres. And over these past 30 years, people in these diverse spheres have had a series of parallel findings, which give us a different view, and really not a new view of humanity. Brain science doesn't give us new philosophies, but it reminds us of some of the old ones. And to me, the interesting thing is they're cold and mechanistic often in the way they do the research, but the implications are not cold and mechanistic at all. They're very enchanted. And this research congregates around some key findings. The first one is that most of our thinking goes on below the level of awareness. One metaphor is that we can take in 12 million pieces of information, of which we can be conscious of about 40. And all the rest is being processed unconsciously. And this leads to some distortions or some oddities in our life. A guy at University of Buffalo found out that people named Dennis are disproportionately likely to become dentists. And people named Lawrence become lawyers because unconsciously we gravitate toward things that sound familiar. Some friends here in the audience know my kids, and they know my daughter is named President of the United States Brooks for that reason. And so those are oddities that are in the unconscious, but the most important things, how you see the world, how you see yourself, how you learn, what models you have to build relationships, the foundations of character, those are also unconscious. The second core finding is that emotions are at the center of our thinking, that people who suffer strokes and lesions that don't allow them to experience emotion are not super smart Mr. Spocks. They are unable to make decisions. Because what emotions do is they assign value to things. They tell us what we want. And if you don't have that, your decision-making landscape is flat, and you actually can't come to a conclusion. Now, I'm a middle-aged guy who loves hanging around the Brookings Institution, so I'm not exactly comfortable talking about emotions. My wife says me writing a book about emotions is like Gandhi writing a book about gluttony. There's actually a great brain scan story I mentioned in the book, though it's apocryphal, to be fair. They took a bunch of middle-aged men, put them in fMRI machines, scanned their brains, had them watch a horror movie, and then had them describe their feelings toward their wives. and the brains were identical in both activities, so just sheer terror doing both. And so I know how that feels. But the elemental fact is that that it is emotion, it is love that forms the brain. There was one experiment, an Austrian experimenter, René Spitz, who came here to the U.S. and studied an orphanage in 1945. And in those days, at least at that place, they decided what they wanted to do to keep babies healthy was to keep them sanitized or sanitary. So they fed them, they gave them great medical care, they did not handle them. And in this orphanage, the mortality rate for babies by age two was 37%. And they stopped naming the babies because they were dying at such high rates. And so without that emotion, the brain really is not forming. And so that's just the importance of emotion. And then the third insight is that we're not primarily self-contained individuals. We're social animals, and we emerge out of relationships. We're not individuals who form contracts. We're relationships first, and then the individuals come out of that. And so when we see each other, there's a controversial notion called mirror neurons, which is when we see someone, we reenact in our own mind what we see them doing. And we not only reenact what we see, we reenact the intentions implied by the action. So if I see somebody pick up a glass to drink it, my mind reacts one way. If I see somebody pick up a glass to put it in the dishwasher, it reacts in a different way. And that shows the level of deep interpenetration. And, you know, it gives us a sense of the deep levels of communication that are perpetually happening between people through smell, through sight, through a million different channels. One experiment done in Germany, they took a bunch of people, put gauze pads under their arms, taped gauze pads, had some people watch a horror movie, some people watch a comedy, and then they had other research subjects sniff the gauze pads and tell which movie did these people watch. And humans can tell it way above average chance somehow just by sniffing the gauze pads. And women, by the way, are much better at this than men for some reason. So this is a sign of the deep interpenetration. And so this research, I think, gives us a different story of how life works. I think we're still primarily children of the French Enlightenment, thinking reason is the highest faculty. And I think this research confirms the view of the British or Scottish Enlightenment, that reason is weak and our sentiments are strong and often trustworthy. And so I think it corrects a bias in the culture and should have an effect of altering the cultural climate to teach us that we're not rational animals, we're social animals, and the brain really exists for sociability. And most germane to what happens here and what I've been thinking about along with people like Bell and many others is I think it affects how we see human capital. We're used to thinking and measuring things like grades, years in schools, degrees, professional skills. But this research points to a bunch of deeper skills which are both emotional and rational and sort of make a hash out of those two categories. And so they include things like mindsight, the ability to enter another's mind and learn what that person has to tell you. So babies come with this ability. So a guy named Alan Meltzoff at the University of Washington did an experiment where he spoke. He leaned over a baby that was 43 minutes old and wagged his tongue at the baby, and the baby wagged her tongue back. And babies come equipped, even though the baby doesn't know herself or a face or what she's looking at, they come equipped to mimic. And that's how they learn. They mimic what they see, and they more or less download the models of reality of mom and dad. And so some babies are able, because mom is attuned to them, to establish a two-way communication. And they develop what the researchers call secure attachments. 55% of the babies in this country have what they call secure attachments. And they'll come in, they have models for how to deal with people, how to deal with adults. And researchers at the University of Minnesota in one study looked at the attachment patterns, these secure attachments, at 18 months and found they could predict with 77% accuracy who was going to graduate from high school. Because they come into school knowing how to relate to teacher. Some kids, about 20%, are what they call avoidantly attached. And they have no attunement coming back at them. And so they have trouble relating to teacher. And one of the teachers in a book I read described a kid walking into kindergarten, tacking into the wind toward the teacher, trying to get close, but not really knowing how to do it, and ending up with his back to the teacher. Just because he wanted to reach out, he just didn't know how that would happen. And people with avoidant attachment patterns have less activation in the reward areas of their brains during social interactions. by age 70, they're going to have many, many fewer friends. Now, nothing that happens in the first 18 months determines a life course, but they open up pathways which either can be confirmed or reversed by later orientation. But it shows the importance of this skill of learning how to relate, which happens very early in life and which is a foundation for achievement. The second skill is equipoise, which is having the serenity and the maturity to monitor the things that are happening unconsciously in your own mind. So, for example, we tend to be overconfidence machines. 95% of college professors say they have above-average teaching skills. 96% of college students have above-average leadership skills. Time magazine in 2000 asked Americans, are you in the top 1% of earners? And 19% of Americans are in the top 1% of earners. Some researchers, Paul Schumacher and Edward Russo, gave tests to executives on their own industries and asked them how confident they were that they knew the answers. And people in the advertising industry said they were 90% confident they got the answers right. In fact, they got 60% of them wrong. People in the computer industry, the most overconfident profession, thought they got 95% of the answers right. They got 80% of them wrong. This, by the way, is a gender-linked trait. Men drown at twice the rate of women because men have a tremendous confidence in their swimming ability, especially after they've been drinking. But some people have the skill to be sensitive to those sorts of biases. Can be open-minded in the face of ambiguity. They can check their natural weaknesses. They have the ability to adjust the strength of evidence to the strength of their conclusions. And so they build these modesty bootstraps for themselves. Peter Drucker had a great one, which where he said, when you make a decision, write down your decision and your reasoning, put it in an envelope, and seal it for 9 months. Then come back. You'll see that 9 months later, about a third of your decisions were right, a third were wrong, a third were somewhere in the middle, but in almost all cases, your reasoning will be completely irrelevant. And so that's sort of a bootstrap. And these abilities have correlate slightly to IQ, but not as strongly as you'd think, these mental character traits. The third is what you might call metis, which is a Greek word, meaning the ability to scan a landscape and see patterns. So my newspaper had a great story a couple of years ago about soldiers in Iraq who could look down a street in Baghdad and tell somehow whether there was likely to be an IED down that street. And when they asked them, how do you know, they would say, oh, I can't really tell you, but I feel cold. And some people have the ability to just sort of detect when something feels wrong. I'm actually reading a great book called The Wayfinders about how people sailed from Indonesia to Hawaii centuries ago, people who had no compasses. And they had a guy who sat on the boat and just observed the shape of the water, the clouds, the seaweed, the sea life, and just by these close observations was able to sail across thousands of miles of open ocean, or at least hundreds of miles. And so that's a level of sensitivity to awareness. And then just one or two other traits. Sympathy, the ability to be attuned to others in a group. Groups come in very handy because they just work much better. One of the things this book changed my mind about is suburbs and cities. My previous book, and this is germane to what happens here at the Metropolitan Project, my previous book was a celebration of the far-flung suburbs, more or less. But it turns out density really does matter. Because one experiment, for example, University of Michigan, they took people and gave them 10 minutes face-to-face to solve a math problem, and they could do it. They gave other groups 30 minutes to solve a math problem, but they had to communicate by email, and those groups failed. Being face-to-face is just tremendously important to magnifying your own skills. And so another study, take a look at patents. People who devise patents have to list all the other patents they relied on to come up with their innovation. The number of patents in these applications, which were invented by people within a 25-mile radius of their life, is tremendously high. People in the epicenter of industries, the geographic epicenter, have much higher productivity rates than people outside. Density really matters, and because some people have this ability to communicate well face-to-face and thus magnify their skills. And now I have zillions of others of these skills, but just two others I'll mention. One is propriety, and this is the ability to see the world in ways that maximize self-restraint. And the most famous experiment in this entire field, which most of you probably know, is the marshmallow experiment, which I've told in this room before. But just very quickly, this guy, Walter Mischel, took a marshmallow, put him on a table, and took four-year-olds, put him in the room, told the four-year-olds one at a time, if you eat the marshmallow now, I'm going to leave the room, and if I come back in 10 minutes and the marshmallow is still here, you haven't eaten it, I'll give you two marshmallows. And the videos of the girls trying not to eat the marshmallow include a girl banging her head on the table. Michelle was using an Oreo cookie, and a little guy picks up the Oreo, eats out the middle, and then carefully puts it back on the table. I think he's in. And that kid is now a U.S. senator. That's my joke. But the kids who could wait 10, 12 minutes, 20 years later, much higher college completion rates. 30 years later, much higher incomes. A lot of kids just pop them right in their mouth. And those kids, 20 years later, much higher incarceration rates, much, much higher drug and alcohol addiction problems. And so it's a sign that some kids live in homes where actions lead to consequences, and they learn strategies to control their impulses. And the way they essentially do it is they see the marshmallow differently. They pretend it's a cloud. They put a frame around it. They somehow distance themselves from the marshmallow. And I think the lesson here is there are certain ways and habits, as Aristotle understood, that we inculcate that allow us to see temptation differently. And those habits start with the simple rules of etiquette, propriety, living an ordered life. And so these are some of the traits that really span reason and emotion. And then the final one I'll mention is one called limerence, which is not so much a trait as a drive or a motivation. What the conscious mind hungers for is money and success and all that stuff. But the unconscious mind hungers for moments of transcendence when the skull line falls away and we're lost in a task, lost in an experience, what an environmentalist feels lost in nature, what a believer feels lost in the love of God. There's a scientist named Andrew Newberg at the University of Pennsylvania who took nuns and monks in meditative states, put them in the brain machines, and basically what he saw was the parts of the brain that allow us to be aware of where our body is at all times, those parts more or less went dark or less active. And so that's what do we hunger for, those moments of self-transcendence, which happen at work sometimes, happen with family, happen with faith and with nature, and most powerfully happen with love one for another. And the decision to fall in love, like all decisions, is part emotional and part rational. When we make that decision of who to marry, there are certain elements that are phenomenally practical. So people tend to marry people with complementary immune systems to themselves, which they can detect through smell. They tend to marry people with similar nose widths. I'm actually not quite sure why that is practical, but they do. Because we marry people like ourselves, basically. We have a bias, similar eye width apart. We have a bias toward marrying people very similar to ourselves. We like to marry people with as high a status as we can. And so one experiment I came across in online dating sites, women tend to marry, like to marry taller guys because each inch of height is equal to about $6,000 in annual income in the United States right now. But a guy who's 5'6" can get as many online date offers as a guy who's 6 foot, so long as he makes $172,000 a year more. So these are sort of rational decisions, but obviously within that there's also a lot of emotion, and there's deep emotional drives, almost addictions, that sweep over people in love. And I start the book with a quotation, a lovely quotation, from a guy named Douglas Hofstadter, who's a great scientist at Indiana University. And his description is of what it's like, which summarizes a lot of the research, because it shows how deeply interpenetrated we are. And it shows that ultimate drive to want to fuse with another. And Hofstadter is writing about himself. He's a scientist. He was off in Italy on a sabbatical. And he was with his wife, Carol, and their two sons, two kids, who were at that point 5 and 2. And Carol succumbed very quickly to, a stroke or some brain disease. And she died when the kids were 5 and 2. And a couple months later, Douglas Hofstadter was in his bedroom, and he was just walking through the bedroom, but he had a picture of Carol on the bureau, and he happened to look at the picture as he was walking through his bedroom, and here's what he wrote in his book, which is called, a great book called I'm a Strange Loop. Here's Hofstadter writing. I looked at her face and looked so deeply that I felt I was behind her eyes. And all at once I found myself saying, as tears flowed, that's me, that's me. And those simple words brought back many thoughts that I had had before, about the fusion of our souls into one higher level entity, about the fact that at the core of both our souls lay our identical hopes and dreams for our children, about the notion that those hopes were not separate or distinct hopes, but were just one hope, one clear thing that defined us both, that welded us into a unit, the kind of unit I had but dimly imagined before being married and having children. I realized that though Carol had died, that core piece of her had not died at all, but that it had lived on very determinedly in my brain. And so the Greeks used to say, we suffer our way to wisdom, and Hofstadter suffered his way to the wisdom that we are shared loops, and that shared loops permeate from one mind to another. And I think through some of the, in a much more shallow way, some of the policy failures of the past couple decades should cause us to suffer our way to the wisdom that the most important regions are down below in the realms of intuition, emotion, character, and that we have to develop and base policy on a fuller view of human nature. When Freud had his conception of the unconscious decades ago, it had a big effect on culture. We now have a different and, I think, more accurate view of human nature, and it should have a similar effect on how we lead our lives and do our policy. And it emphasizes the importance of educating your emotions. It emphasizes the importance, and that's done through literature and other things. It emphasizes the importance of looking not only at individual traits, but at the quality of relationships between two people. And I think most germane to Brookings, I think it emphasizes the need for a second generation set of human capital policies. That the first generation allowed us to get kids into college and into high school. But the second generation set of human capital policies will help us give them the traits to actually get through these places so they can complete high school and complete college. And some of those are academic that we're comfortable talking about, but some of those enabling kids to build relationships in high school and college, to exercise self-control, to establish the sort of vision of themselves, the identity of themselves they need to actually learn and plan for the future. A whole series of much deeper traits that I've tried to describe here. And so it's been, for me, an unexpected journey. I'm not the most emotional guy in the world. But if you want to cover where the action is and what's really important, I think this takes you in the region where the most important realm of research and the most germane realm for those of us who try to think about policy and try to enhance social mobility. So thank you very much.
I have been David's friend for quite a while now, and it's amazing the things you learn if you're David's friend. For example, David explained to me that because I am called EJ, I defend agencies like EPA, FDIC, SEC, OSHA, and presidents like FDR, LBJ, and JFK. I thought it was because I'm a liberal, but I learned from David that it's all my subconscious mind.
What about the NRA? You never defend them.
If I were a woman called Consuela, I'd be a conservative. I was grateful to Strobe for remembering David Broder, who I think really is the most generous colleague any of us has ever encountered. He loved talking to people, especially to voters, and in keeping with today's theme, he was the best sort of social animal. He was a giver, he was a listener, and a sharer, and a friend, and we will miss him a lot. I love David, too. I mean, we like the American Whig Party community, the writer Robert Nisbet, baseball, and we disagree about everything else. That's actually not true, but I have learned that Brooksian exaggeration is a central part of his writing approach. And so having read the 6,252 reviews of this book already published, the 3,221 interviews David has given, and the 439 columns he has written over the years previewing his findings, I feel I have an acute understanding of where he is coming from. I was struggling where to begin with David on this extraordinary book, and a friend told me about a Woody Allen quote, and Woody Allen said, my brain is my most important organ, but look who's telling me that. And I guess where I wanted to start with David, otherwise I've always wanted to have David discourse on why he hates the class he is part of so much. I've always said David is a conservative Marxist because no one has attacked the upper class with such glee. But instead I want to ask him about what is I see. And I'm only going to ask a few questions just so you know how we're proceeding today. I'm going to ask a few questions. There are a couple of reviews I want to give David a chance to respond to. Then I'm going to turn to my colleague Bell Sawhill because for all his disdain of reason, which I will get to in a moment, he comes up supporting the reasonable and rational policies of my colleague Bell Sawhill. So Bell will open the questioning, and then I want to turn it to everyone else. And David has to leave around 10:20 because he's got to do a radio show to promote this book. He is rational. He believes enough in rationality to believe in book promotion. What I wanted to talk about is one tension and one disappearance in the book. The tension is over reason itself. Because on the one hand, I read your column, and what I see in it constantly is a defense of reason as applied to social policy. And one of the reasons you have all these liberal fans who get mad at you is because they say at least he's evidence-based and all of that. And yet, you have written a book saying reason isn't what it's cracked up to be. How do you square this contradiction within yourself, and how are we to read the book?
Well, you know, I think the central fallacy of a lot of our thinking is to think that reason and emotion are separate. I think they're one thing. And so when you say reason isn't, or what is more accurate to say that consciousness is not everything, that's not mean to say you have to become hysterical. It's to say a couple things. It's to say that what we call your emotions are often quite reasonable if you define reason as leading in your best interests. But it's also to say you have two systems, two ways of thinking. One is logical, linear, and linguistic. The other, below the level of awareness, is more associational, more pattern-based. They're just, the unconscious is not, an emotion is not a tangled web of sexual urges, as Freud thought. It's just a different way of seeing the world, of helping you make sense of the world. And so you have these two ways of analyzing the world, both of which have strengths, both of which have weaknesses. So just because you rely sometimes on your intuition, or on more accurately processes below the level of awareness, does not mean you shut down this other system, which sometimes plays a very useful role in policing what your emotions are telling you or in shaping your emotions. You can control your emotions by how you educate yourself. And so I guess I just reject the distinction that there's one thing called reason, which is intelligent, and this other thing called emotion, which is different. They're all part of the same process.
Could you talk a little bit, because you do write a political column and talk about politics a lot, about the interaction of reason and emotion when people make political decisions? Because I think there's, especially after the rise of totalitarianism, there was a great fear of anything except reason to define our politics. And yet you seem to give a considerable respect to the non-reason in coming to political conclusions.
Yeah. So there are many different experiments which illustrate the effect of unconscious processes. One was by a guy named Todorov at Princeton, where he gave people a one-second glimpse at various races and asked them, the two competing candidates, just their faces for 1 second. He said, who's going to win this race? Who strikes you as more competent? And people could predict the winner in each race with about 70% accuracy, just with this one-second look. Then other researchers took this results to Mexico, to Argentina, I think to Soviet Georgia, former Soviet Georgia, and showed them the same faces, and those people could produce the exact same results. And so we have a template in our mind of what is competence. Another experimenter took people in gubernatorial races, showed them 10-minute videos with the sound off and the sound on, and asked them predict who would win, and the people who saw the videos with the sound off did a better job. And so that shows that there are certain templates we have of what is competence. But my basic view of politics is it's most of our judgments and most of our party affiliations are not based on a careful explication of the rival healthcare plans. We look at the parties and say, who is like us? It's social identity. And then once we form an identity with a party, we tend to adopt its philosophy. Now, it's not only that. There's obviously a process of study that's involved, but it's more of that than we generally allow, I think.
I think he's telling us to close up shop.
No, I mean, the way we study policy is also, you know, it also plays a key role, but it also informs us of what deep down we think is competence. So people have midlife political conversions, and that can be from reading Brookings papers, but it will have a deep effect on them and how they see their personal identity as well.
So we need to do studies of the emotional impact of our papers as we do as we do them. What about power? It was a category that was in a way missing from the analysis, although it's implicit in a lot of ways. But power kind of disappeared from this view, and it was all right. About relationships. And at times I thought you were buying into the very Bethesda, touchy-feely, upper-class view of the world that you so brilliantly satire.
Yeah, that's a good point. There's not that much. The one place it comes in is there's a section on morality where I'm really summarizing the research of a school of scientists led by Jonathan Haidt and others who are moral intuitionists. They think when we come with moral rules, we do not do it in a Kantian way of what are our principles and then deriving logical conclusions. Morality is more like taste or aesthetics, that we look at something and we come up with an immediate moral response. You do not have to tell a 12-year-old or a 2-year-old what fairness is. They know what fairness is. And one of the intuitions we have, well, we have very powerfully in-group and out-group, where a lot of the cruelty of the world comes from, but we also have a hunger for power, for dominance, and reactions to dominance in those relationships, which have both positive effects and sometimes extremely harsh and cruel effects. So they can look at the way the brain reacts to dominant figures, and you can see instantaneous reactions. So it's in there, but you're right, I don't tease that out too much.
One other question before I go to two reviewers' comments. By the way, why did you choose to invent Harold and Erica? The Economist, as you know, loved your book, except they wish you had dumped
right.
Harold and Erica.
Right.
Why did you, for those of you who haven't read the book yet, the book goes back and forth between learned studies of the brain and the life story of Harold and Erica, and the description of Harold dying at the end of the book is really quite remarkable. It's almost like you wrote it on LSD. I mean, it's really, or in a religious trance. I mean, it's
right.
a very powerful ending. Why did you choose to do it that way?
For three reasons. One, I don't think, well, in abstractions, I need to see sort of examples, and having two characters sort of live out the research gave me those examples. Second, I just thought it would be more fun. I could make fun of Aspen.
That's what I thought. Yeah, it was all an excuse to make fun of all their habits.
And third, if you take the message of the book that information hits us on multiple levels at once, I wanted the book to hit us on multiple levels at once. And so I understood when I started this that it was the riskiest thing to do, because the book basically is a popularization of about 10 different academic fields, which is hard enough, and then to layer on an allegory on top of it, that struck me as harder still. But my reaction was, hey, I've got a day job. I might as well take a chance on this. So that was sort of my thinking, and it made it more fun. Some people think it makes it a lot more fun to read. Some people don't. So there's reaction to the allegory, and I distinguish between allegory and fiction. Allegory is simply supposed to represent research, whereas a fictional character is very much more idiosyncratic. And when I reread the book, I think it pays off. Some people do, but the Economist reviewer did not, and he's not alone.
It's clearly a subconscious rather than a rational reaction
yeah.
to. Just on the studies, the Wall Street Journal gave David one of the longest reviews I have ever seen. They wrote more about David even than about supply-side economics. That's not true either. But one of the critiques, I'll just read you the passage, which I know you're familiar with. It was basically that the core critique was there are a lot more studies in this area and that you paid attention to the ones that sort of tended to prove the points you wanted to make, and particularly on intelligence. Just a couple of sentences. In fact, studies do measure both intelligence and economic outcomes that measure both intelligence and economic outcomes find positive relationships. David sort of downplays intelligence in making someone rich. When you consider that IQ can be measured well in a half an hour, these effects are surprisingly large, and so on. Just in general, when you read, what did you make of this critique of you?
Yeah, so a couple things. One is, first of all, IQ matters to income. If you read my chapter of the book, I thought there were two things he misread. Let's see if I can remember them both. IQ definitely matters to income. It's definitely a significant player in people with higher IQs, definitely have higher incomes. And then he claims that I think IQ tests are invalid. I never wrote that, never would claim that. That's an absurdity. IQ makes a difference. The question is how much difference. And so in the book, I cite two studies, one that from one set of researchers that said 4% of the difference in job variation is related to IQ. And then the second study I cite says 20% of life success is related to IQ. And in his book, he only mentions that I cited the 4% and says that's way too low. And he says the average is more about 25%. In retrospect, I probably should have cited another study that has higher, just the median of the research is probably around 20-25% of job variation can be explained by IQ. And in retrospect, I emphasized two studies, one on the low side, one on the median side. I should have had one on the high side. But to me, this is a matter of perception. To me, the fact that only 25% of job performance, or the variance in job performance, can be defined by IQ, to me, that's lower than I thought. And so I wrote the chapter saying it's much less important than we think. And a lot of people, especially in that field, when I say it's loosely connected to job performance, they took that to mean I think it's zero relation to job performance. They think I'm lowering it, whereas to me, I think we both agree on the data, it's just how we phrase it. And so if you tell me that IQ matters 25% to job performance, that's surprisingly low to me, and that was the point of that. But he attacked me for saying it was zero, which I would never say and did not say.
The other one I like, which is classic Brooksian, when stock traders experience a series of good days, the dopamine released into their brains creates a surge of overconfidence. He says you only cited a blog post for that.
Yeah, that's not fair either. The research was done by a guy named Andrew Lowe at MIT, who's a very significant player in the field, and Lowe sent me about six of his studies. I may have put a blog post in the table of contents, but there are many studies. And the Andrew Lowe stuff is, I see it quoted all the time. And when I did the book, because I'm not in the field, I tried to quote what scientists in the field quote. And just on the IQ stuff, one book I highly recommend is a book by a guy at the University of Toronto named Keith. It's called What IQ Tests Miss. The author is Keith Stanovich. And that's a lot of the intelligence stuff that he objected to is in that book. And again, Stanovich is a major figure in the field. I got nothing that I did no research, obviously. I just quoted other people. And there's ferocious differences within the field. And some people are going to be upset that I quoted one group and not another. I tried to be as cautious as possible, but I'm bound to have missed stuff.
The other review I wanted to ask you about was Alan Wolf's, where he did in the New Republic, where he did sort of choose to sort of pick a political argument with you,
I haven't read that one.
Oh, okay. Let me just read you a passage to respond to, then one last question, then Bell. He said, the most impressive of the mechanisms that human beings, it's a very positive review, all these reviews are positive, by the way, the most impressive of the mechanisms that human beings have created to control the instability of the passions is called liberal democracy. I'm not quite so prepared as Brooks to limit the freedom it offers. He talks about your love of nudging these days, the conviction that human beings are irrational and that public policy needs to take into account just how often we do not know what is best for us is truly trans-ideological, but the science behind it is not as conclusive as these writers maintain, and so on. Do you see there are a lot of sort of in the broadest sense of the term liberals who would be uncomfortable with the way you treat reason in this book. Could you talk about that a little bit?
See the free market economists or the Milton Friedmanites, they're also uncomfortable.
I mean, there is they're liberals in the broad sense.
Right. And so a lot of the book is a critique of some of the highly rational academic disciplines. classical economics, post-Knight, post-Friedman, modern philosophy, modern political scientists, game theory. I think all that stuff is overly linear, logical, and rational. And I think the research suggests that those models of human nature, which everybody knows are, like, everyone agrees, even the economists agree, it's like 20% off. I think it's closer to 50% off to how human beings actually are. And so I think the research, but this is a debate. And, because I'm pushing against a rational model, I'm probably pushing harder than I would if I were pushing against, if we lived in a society where we were all Oprah Winfrey's, I'd push toward reason. But the point is, you can't swing between reason and emotion from rationalism to romanticism. They're both. Both are involved in all the decisions we make. One of the things I thought you were going with the Alan Wolf quote, and I guess I haven't read the review yet, but he talks about the impingements on freedom. And this is a core political problem. If you take the first 3 years of life very seriously, and if you think that many people in the society, many kids in the society, are being raised in very disorganized and very destructive ways, then you almost call for either agencies of faith or charity or even government to go in very paternalistic ways and interfere with dysfunctional families. And that paternalism should make all of us uncomfortable, the state going in and basically interfering with a mother's relationship to a child. And yet, I think it's better than having the kids sit in the car seat 8 hours a day drinking Coca-Cola out of a baby bottle. And so that's the tension. I'm not sure I trust government to go into family life, but I'm not sure I want families, especially at the most disorganized level, sustaining themselves generation upon generation.
That's a perfect transition to Bell. I was going to ask you one positive question, but you can keep it in the back of your head. The flip side of the free market economists and certain rationalist liberals not liking you is I've run into a couple of religious people who've read the book who believe you're smuggling theology back in by way of brain science. And keep that in the back of your head. But I want to turn to Bell because there isn't a lot of policy in the book, but to the extent that there is policy in the book, it's Bell, Saul Hill, and Ron Haskins policy.
I completely agree with that, by the way.
So. Bell.
Well, I'm a big fan of David Brooks, as I think he knows, and I know other people know. But I am really struggling with this book and the ideas in it. And I think what I'm struggling with is what are the implications for private behavior, for public policy, and for our politics. So let me take each of those very briefly in turn. And this will, to some extent, further extend what I think EJ was asking you and what some of these reviewers have raised as well. On private behavior, I think that there is in all of us a tendency to want reason to dominate emotions, not to the exclusion of not recognizing emotions, and certainly we should value them, and your book does have the merits of beginning to maybe rebalance our thinking about that. But I worry about us going too far. I mean, take the marshmallow story, and the children who were able to leave the marshmallow on the table were very successful later on. Now, maybe that's a trait that you call emotional and unconscious and something we haven't given enough attention to, and maybe this is a labeling or a definitional issue, but to me, that is an example of cognitive self-awareness trumping the bad child within, and that all of us as adults struggle with not eating too much, not exercising too little, all those kinds of things. And I think we attribute that to reason and to looking forward in a planful way and being quite conscious of it. So what are the implications for private behavior of your research? All of your book is kind of a description of what is. I guess what I'm pressing on here is what lessons for our own behavior or for our public behavior do we take from this? On the public policy front, I think there is quite a lot of recognition now that we need to take into account non-cognitive skills, that we need to take into account that people don't always do rational, self-interested thing, that there's a lot of self-destructive behavior out there, and the whole notion of nudging people in the right direction to do what's in their own long-term interest through public policy is a good one. I mean, the whole movement from unconditional welfare to providing, let's say, the earned income tax credit is a great example of making public policy conditional on getting people to do what we'd like them to do, which is to work to the extent they're able. On our politics, I think everybody now is concerned about how dysfunctional our politics seems to be. And a lot of that seems to be wrapped up in the, you know, a lot of what you joked about at the beginning, that there is a shallowness and a very emotional tilt to it. And some of that is not healthy and good, it seems to me. I mean, we don't want politicians playing on our unconscious prejudices and our myopia and our desire to have more government than we're willing to pay for, and all of that. And so, again, I'm really wondering about the right balance between these things and whether some people will worry that your book, by giving so much credit to these sort of non-cognitive, non-reason factors in behavior, will lead to better outcomes, even either in private lives or in public life.
Yeah. Okay. Those are all good comments. They echo something Stephen Colbert said to me last night. He thought my book vindicated his worldview that he didn't have to think about stuff. And again, I come back to this distinction that that I really think the distinction between reason and emotion is a bogus distinction, that the two are intertwined ineluctably. And maybe it's best to better talk. I do more in the book of consciousness and unconscious processes. And I sort of got into this book. You mentioned the phrase non-cognitive, which I read. I remember I had a moment. I was reading Jim Heckman on the importance of the first 3 years, and he says most of the traits are non-cognitive. And I said, what's non-cognitive? Like a chair is non-cognitive. But people are not non-cognitive. It's just different sorts of cognition. And so in the personal behavior level, say with the marshmallow, I would say one of the research, what the research does is, that, again, it directs our attention a little, it shifts our attention. So if you have a simple decision-making model, I see the world, I analyze the world, and then I execute through willpower. And I would say in the last 100 years, we've spent a lot of time thinking about willpower, especially the Victorians were big on that. We've spent a lot of time thinking about analysis. How do I weigh the pros and cons? But I think this research shows us that perception is actually the most important of those activities, how we perceive the world, because perceiving involves a lot of processing. It's a very deep process. And so Aristotle said, if you inculcate certain habits, that will teach you to perceive the world in different ways, in ways that are probably non-conscious. But that'll help organize all the subsequent steps. And so that's why, on a personal thing, I think you need etiquette, you need order to give those habits, which then become automatic ways of perceiving the world.
Is it sort of like all this brain science proves that your friend Burke was right all along?
Well, I think Aristotle comes out pretty good. David Hume comes out pretty good. Like I say, people have been observing human nature for a long time. It doesn't come up with anything new. And some of the observations are phenomenally, now that we have all these scientists coming up with this stuff, reconfirming what Hume or Aristotle thought just by pure observation. It's really, truly impressive what the things they observed. Then on the, just on the dysfunctional politics, one of the big, I think, lessons of this research is how little we know about ourselves and how little we know about the world. There's a great, I think it's a George Eliot line, imagine playing chess where all the pieces of the chessboard had their own minds and they were doing off what they wanted to do. And then imagine they all had multiple minds. And then imagine you as the player had multiple minds. This shows you how little you understand about the world. And so when you approach politics, you should be extremely aware of your own shortcomings and extremely aware of the need for others to balance your own opinions. And to me, polarization and extreme partisanship is a form of narcissism. It's no accident that Rush Limbaugh is both extremely partisan and extremely egomaniacal. Because if you're that egomaniacal, you think the people who disagree with me are just in the way. And so I think one of the things the research should make us more aware of how little we know, and therefore we need the process of conversation to conduct policy. And again, to embrace non-cognitive processes or unconscious processes is not to embrace hysteria, what I said to Stephen Colbert last night. He was confusing emotion and horniness. And so the two are sort of different things.
How did he respond?
He said he wanted to have sex with my book.
This gentleman over here will elaborate on that point.
What a lead in. That's kind of hard to follow. But you said that a party that is a part of social identity, nolabels.org, you've written something about them, and I think they're a new organization to go with, but No Labels is not the right name for it.
Right.
It's more like cognitive thinking. But could you comment on that, please?
Yeah, I do agree that, that I sort of got involved. Bill Golston, who's in the back of the room, is involved in that, and I got involved because I have trouble seeing how our two parties, as currently structured, help us solve issues like the fiscal situation. I have trouble seeing how they resolve global warming issues. I have just frustration with the policy process. So I think the folks in No Labels are doing good things. I object or disagree with a movement that begins with the word no. And so what I try to, I think, is the right answer is a positive philosophy, which is sort of sketched in the book, but is really at home here in this building probably more than any other spot on Earth, which derives from Alexander Hamilton fundamentally. And the shorthand version of it is there's a liberal philosophy in this country that believes in using government to enhance equality. There's a conservative philosophy that believes in limited government to enhance freedom. But then there's a third tradition in American life that believes in limited but energetic government to enhance social mobility. And it starts with Hamilton. It goes through the Whig Party. It goes through Abraham Lincoln. And then it sort of peters out, with the exception of the Hamilton Project here. And some people, I think, actually in the Obama administration, Jason Furman was here, Peter Orszag, who's left. There are certain people, and we could have a rightward version or a leftward version, but giving people the tools to compete. And then the only thing, the way this book contributes to that, is saying what are the tools people need to compete. They're not only economic, though that's part of it, but they're also psychological and social.
It's one of the things David and I share. Everything we agree on is explained by Whigs. It's very peculiar. This gentleman over here, and we have time for a couple more.
It seems that the world, to a degree, needs very social animals and not so social animals. It needs the Bill Clinton and the used car salesman. It needs the Philip Roth and the research scientist who will labor away by himself. But can you talk a little bit about how these issues of cognition, emotion, intelligence relate to personal fulfillment and happiness? So someone who's 6'6" and makes $170,000 a year may not be so happy,
right,
compared to someone, you know, a foot shorter and $100,000 poorer.
Right.
So talk a little bit about how it relates to actual, right, happiness and life fulfillment.
Right. First, being a social animal is not the same as being a party animal. So you don't have to be gregarious. I'm not a particularly gregarious guy myself, but some people have their most profound social relationships with others who've been dead for hundreds of years. They read their books or study their music or look at their paintings. And so those interpenetrations are just as powerful. As far as the happiness research, Carol Graham was here, knows it better than I, but I think the shorthand version is that the relationship between money and happiness is somewhat powerful, but the relationship between friendship and happiness is tremendously powerful, and that's the shorthand. The more connections, the better. Some studies, some of which Danny Kahneman and Alan Krueger did a study where they looked at the activity, that the daily activity most conducive to happiness, and that's eating out with friends, the daily activity most harmful to
this
happiness.
This book is sponsored by a whole group of restaurants.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, and this goes to the Metropolitan Project. The daily activity most harmful to happiness is commuting, spending time alone in the car. And the research is very clear, and Durkheim understood this a long time ago, that the more connections you got, the better you're going to be.
Somebody else, please.
Hi, I was very interested in your aspect about people in research in particular being too linear. And I was just reading something about Darwin, actually, and how a lot of people used his ideas to promote things like eugenics. And I wonder, and obviously he was somebody who had empathy for other people. He was staunch in terms of being anti-slavery. And how much maybe it would have improved things for his ideas later if he had tried to maybe avoid going too much the linear route and encompassed some of the ideas that he had to make people more empathetic and how these things could have been taken so people couldn't hijack that stuff to for their own negative ideas.
Yeah. Well, there seems to be a bias toward taking one set of teachings, even very important teachings, and trying to make a system which explains everything out of it. And so I one of the things that's happening now is that a lot of evolutionary psychologists are writing about all sorts of things. And a lot of what they write strikes me as very persuasive, especially when it comes to mating and things that are clearly more more involved in passing down the genes. But when I read what they write about shopping and politics, sometimes I think they're taking the certain things we imagine or theorize about happening in Pleistocene-era societies and very simply trying to transpose it onto us. And I think there's core insights that are obviously very, very valuable, but simply taking what certain truths and patterns we imagine happened in the Pleistocene era and applying it to why Paris looks the way it does or New York looks the way it does or why Mozart composed the way he did, I think that's a bit of a stretch, and I don't think there's one system that we, a theoretical system that we can use to explain everything. And I guess that that's certainly been happened to Darwin's work.
Just thinking about that Darwin question, when you think of this book, what is your biggest fear about how people will misapply it?
I think it is the idea that we're not, they'll say, oh, he thinks reason is weak, therefore emotion is strong, and therefore I don't need to study. And my kids already come into that with that feeling. No, I'm just kidding. They're good students. Again, we're so beholden by the distinction between reason and emotion. We think they're like two sides of a seesaw. They are not. They're part of the same process. But those categories are locked in our minds. And so they'll think, oh, if reason is down, emotion must be up. But that's not the way it works. They're not on a seesaw. They're interpenetrated with each other, and you can educate your emotions. Some people have smart emotions, some people have dumb ones. Some people are good at using reason, some are bad. And they're just two different ways of seeing the world.
Thank you. I'm afraid, do we have time for one more? A quick question, a quick answer. This gentleman right back there.
If the book, it sounds like it's a critique of Western Enlightenment.
French, not British.
So how does it then apply to development and the spread of these very ideas, democracy, liberalism, freedom, which is now being replicated? So how does it apply to globalization?
Yeah, well, I guess I would say two quick things, and I'm afraid I have to run right after this. One, I highly recommend a book called Seeing Like a State by a writer at Yale named Scott. I'm now blanking on his first name. James. And it's about how certain development agencies were seeing local societies through the prism of sort of macroeconomics and doing terrible development policies, whereas he emphasized the power of context. I'm really not doing justice to his ideas. It was from that book that I got the word metis, actually. Just in terms of what we're seeing in the world today, when you read about all these emotional contagions, well, then I think what happens in the Middle East doesn't surprise you, how a contagion can sweep across a region and people can behave and see things in one way one day and then a different self is aroused another day. And so I think it prepares you for that, and it prepares you for the hunger for dignity, that we do have an innate hunger, an innate desire to be recognized. In the book, I use the Greek word thumos, the thymotic urge. Just to see things in those ways, at least it prepares you. I don't know if it gives you policy responses, what to do in Libya, but it prepares you for events like the sweeping democratic revolutions or even the sweeping stupidity of the financial bubble, because you see how people interpenetrate another and how emotional contagions get going.
I just want to close by saying one of the reasons I loved David is because he likes paradox and irony. For example, I went up to him this morning when he was signing books, and I said, I want to be relational and welcome you to Brookings. And he said, drop dead. I don't believe in that stuff. I only write about it. So I couldn't tell whether an interview with Newsweek, he was being ironic. He said, preparing to embark on his book tour, Brooks is apprehensive. I'm dreading it. I'll feel lonely. And so I just wanted you to know you can always come back to Brookings, which people don't realize is an ashram. You can join us for a powerless lunch, and we will surround you with fellowship and emotional support and love. Thank you very much.